What's up, y'all, and welcome back to In the Wild. I am your host, Rayshawn, and today, because it is the week of midterms, we're talking a little bit, because if you're like me, you may be feeling a little bit of burnout during this time, or you're trying to not lose steam. So we have an on-campus expert to talk to us a little bit about burnout and how to keep us going to finish the semester strong. He is the chair for the Department of Social Sciences, so give a big welcome to Dr. William Hatcher. How's it going?
Thanks, Rayshawn. I appreciate you having me on to talk about this important topic of burnout and work-life balance, especially with everybody going through midterms. But faculty and staff, we're burned out and tired a lot of times, too. You know, a lot of times we're just exhausted, and that's because of the increased difficulties that people have balancing work and life and family, and that leading to more and more burnout at all levels. Yeah.
So how are things going for you so far in your department, in your neck of the woods? Because it's a busy time.
It's a busy time. You know, my job's a busy one. I'm a professor of public administration, and I came to Augusta University in 2015 to direct our Master of Public Administration program. Since then, and since 2020, and during the pandemic, I've been chair of the Department of Social Sciences. And in that department, we have 6 undergraduate majors, 2 graduate degrees, and, oh, it's hard to keep count of all the certificates and minors we have. We have a little bit of everything. If you're interested in national security, we're the place for that. If you're interested in nonprofit management, public administration, yeah, we're the place for that. If you're interested in social work, you know, we have a little bit of everything. So that keeps me busy. So it's really led me to be even more concerned about our topic today, burnout, how to balance everything, how to make sure we have priorities set. So, you know, we're not leading to a situation where burnout is having a negative effect on our work, but also our life and our health.
Yeah, going back to the pandemic, I feel that was the first time for a lot of folks they were able to slow down. Yeah. And as we kind of move past the social isolation part of the pandemic, things are picking back up again. We're back into being in this like fast-paced world. So why do you think achieving a healthy work-life balance is so important?
It's important for a host of reasons. You know, studies have shown that when people are burned out and they don't have a proper work-life balance, it affects their health, it affects their happiness, and it also affects our workplaces. Our workplaces aren't as productive when you have a lot of burnout, a lot of turnover in positions, and you don't have people who have a nice approach to work and life. You know, this discussion of work-life balance and burnout was really starting before the pandemic. The pandemic really accelerated it. But if you look at Google searches going back 10 years, you can see an increased interest in people searching to learn more about work-life, learning more about burnout. Studies looking at workplace stress have showed an increase in workplace stress over the last 10 to 15 years, but dramatically from the pandemic. And I think a lot of that has to do with we have more demands on our work and life today than we ever have in many ways. And our economy in many ways also is still designed for many positions to be that 9-to-5, the industrial revolution type economy where you go and work in a factory. That's not the economy we have. Folks that work in our economy today, large portions of it, don't work 9-to-5 jobs, and they're on call 24/7 sometimes, or feel like they need to be. So it's really important for them to take more of an active role in trying to balance work and life. And to a certain degree, as much as they can, you can't have that ideal balance. And there's a problem when we try to work too much on balancing, because that's just one more thing that adds to our plate and makes us exhausted. Because you can't have that perfect work-life balance. But it's really something you should think about as a student, as a professional, throughout all stages of your life. Because if studies have shown over and over again, if you don't have strong work-life balance or thinking about it, you get burned out. That affects your health. That affects your work. That affects your family. It just ripples across everything.
And you recently published a book that focuses on burnout and work-life balance, specifically with higher education. Could you talk about what inspired you to go into that topic and the research that you found or any insights?
Sure. Well, I had a period, and it was before I became chair, which is a whole other host of challenges, which are great challenges, but still a lot of having to balance work and life. But around 2017 or so, I had a period where I was pretty burned out. And burnout leads to you feeling cynical, more negative about things you normally wouldn't be negative about, feeling like you don't have as much control over your professional life, but also feeling very exhausted. The World Health Organization has determined and discussed and really treated burnout over the last few years as a syndrome, as a health syndrome, because of the effects that it has on people's health when they're burnout. And I had a period where I was really exhausted, and you know, like a lot of things with social scientists, you try to diagnose yourself when you shouldn't. But so I spent a lot of time reading about burnout, and that led to a couple essays on burnout in my field in public administration and how burnout affects public organizations, nonprofits, and our overall government. If workers, public servants are burned out, they're not doing as good of a job at work. To this book. So there was a transition along the way, but a lot of it went back to I had a period where I struggled with burnout, where I was exhausted, where I was more cynical about things. You know, I'm pretty easygoing, and I was finding myself being a lot not as easygoing and more cynical. And that's a lot of the research shows that those three things happen when you don't have a good work-life balance. You tend to move toward burnout, and then once you start moving into burnout, you'll start to be really cynical, exhausted, and you don't feel like you're not having an effect in a positive manner on your job.
So what was that experience like being able to actually publish a book?
Oh, it's fun most of the time. But no, that's one of the main things we do is research along with teaching and service. In my field, there's a good mixture between focusing more on articles, but also there's a decent number of folks who do books. Over the last few years, I've done more and more books. The book that we did on work-life balance is an edited book. I also serve as co-editor-in-chief of the Journal of Public Affairs Education.
Oh, nice.
And we took the an issue that we dedicated to burnout and made it into that book. Just because of the feedback we got from the issue that we had with the journal, just how much attention it got and how people within the field of public administration, you know, scholars that are working to teach people to be public servants, but also public servants, people working out in the field, just how it really, you know, they saw a lot in that burnout that described what they're dealing with. So we did the book. It's interesting. I don't have any copies. I was going to bring copies, but they only give us three because they're so expensive. We don't have any copies. But I'm also working on another book now that where we're going to do some original research, where we do surveys looking at burnout and work-life balance among city managers, city administrators, local government officials. We're looking at it, how what cities, what counties, what states do a good job of helping their employees with work-life balance, doing some case studies with that. So we're working on another book. It's a long process, though. You do a proposal, you wait to hear for the proposal. Then you get if it gets accepted, then you have to write it. And I just finished another book that took 3 years because of the pandemic, and that's why I said it's fun most of the time.
So I guess zooming in a little bit more, what would you say are some of the contributing factors in the higher education setting that make burnout so real, or work-life balance a difficulty for college students, employees?
It's difficult. I know one of the things that popped up a lot when we were looking at work-life balance among faculty is that faculty are doing what in many ways they have a passion in. It may change over time, but they're doing what they have a passion in. So it's hard for them to draw a line between I'm just working now, I'm reading this book as a hobby or as something outside of work. Because it all interrelates. They work a job that's really not a 9-to-5. And so do students. Students are balancing part-time jobs, sometimes full-time jobs, family life, their friends. They're balancing a host of classes that, you know, some may be during the day, some may be at night, some may be online. So it's not this standard way that used to do a better job of describing how we lived and worked, where we worked from 9-to-5 and then we can disconnect after that. So that makes it harder for individuals because they have to be more proactive in trying to disconnect. when you work a 9-to-5 job, growing up, I worked in retail. And I worked at JCPenney's and Belts, and it was set hours. You know, I could disconnect when that day was over with and just move away from work. But what I do now, I can't, you know? So you have to have clear boundaries and set priorities about what's important for you and how you're going to put that in place. So you have to do a lot of self-reflection and think about, you know, that that I'm going to spend X amount of time on this project, but then also to do as well in work as I want to, I've got to put in time with my family. I've got to put in time with my friends. I got to get away from it. It takes a lot of self-reflection and discipline to do that.
Are there any other like best practices or strategies that you have to help be proactive about managing burnout?
Yeah, you know, one of the main theoretical frameworks in the research about how organizations can develop their policies to try to stop burnout, it's called the demand, control, and support model. And really that can apply to you as individuals, that you put yourselves in situations where the demands are realistic, you have support, you work in organizations, you go to universities like ours where you have the support you need. And then when you have that, when you don't have unrealistic demands and you have the support you need, you feel like you have more control over your daily lives. And that really leads to a decrease of burnout oftentimes, where you give employees as organizations realistic demands, more control and more support. They tend to do a better job trying to balance everything. And it's the same thing with individuals. When they approach it that way, kind of building strategies from that broader idea that, you know, I need to be in places that value me and give me realistic demands. I need to be in places where I get the support I need. And that gives me more control. Kind of fitting those strategies, their personal strategies under those three, really a good model to think about how to balancing your work and life and everything else.
So as chair of a department, yeah. How do you incorporate your expertise into helping your faculty kind of maintain and manage their work-life balance?
Well, I really use that model a lot. I use the idea that realistic demands, as much support as I can do, and to give faculty, staff, as much control over their schedules and their work as possible. You know, we have looked at and asked faculty members, and this can apply to a lot of workers and to students, what are some of the most important things that you get out of a job? And oftentimes they come back and say flexibility. I need flexibility. I need flexible work schedules. I need flexibility when I'm focused on at work, just as long as you're under the demands of your organization or its overall mission. So we do a lot of that, a lot of just approaching the job within this idea of demand, control, and support, where you're being kind and compassionate. You know, you're practicing compassion as much as you can. That's really important. Because organizations that don't do a good job of balancing work and life and have a lot of employees burning out, they also have other negative outcomes, such as larger instances of bullying and harassment. So a good way to look at these issues is they're all interrelated. You see that in a lot of organizations that struggle with work-life balance. There's a lot of other toxic factors. So approach it in a way is to be as compassionate as you can, be as understanding, practice a caring approach to management organizations or how I run my classes, even in a way I follow that. So, but it all goes back to that idea that people can only take so many demands on their time. They have to balance everything. They want a sense of control, and they want to feel like they have the support they need to do their job, but also their, live their lives.
Is that any different for college students, I guess? And like you mentioned before, they have a lot of different factors that kind of helps with their overall structure.
Yeah.
So as a professor, how is that any different for working with college students?
I think there's a lot of overlap with working with how we design our organizations, whether it's private or public, to get the most out of that and make sure our employees feel like they belong, like they're happy, they're productive and getting as most as they can realization out of their jobs. It's the same way with our students. We want to make sure our classes, they get the most they can out of our classes and our academic programs. And a lot of that, too, has to go back to this idea that we don't want to place demands that are unreasonable on students. We want to give them a certain degree of control over learning. You know, it shows up and up again in research on teaching and learning that when students have a certain amount of control over the subjects they're learning, it just lights something in them. You know, I started off, I won't name majors because I know we got so many majors here, but I started off in one major and went to a very different one. Political science, I'll name that one because that's the one I ended up in. And because of a lot of that, so I felt like I had a control over my what I was learning and got really passionate about it. In a lot of situations, humans don't respond as well when you have too many rules and take away control. So that's this end that leads to feelings of burnout, whether it's at work, but also in your classes. And just following that idea that we were talking about, being as compassionate as possible, but also worrying about demands, worrying about support, and giving people as much control as possible.
So switching gears a little bit.
Yeah.
What's your go-to stress relief activity when you need a break from work? Like, how do you unplug, decompress?
A lot of things. Like in grad school, I was more active in grad school, more athletic. I've never really been athletic, but I was more, I would jog. I do a little bit of that now. My wife and I, we live in North Augusta, and we use the Greenway a lot, bikes. I spend a lot of time with my cats. My cats are a great stress relief. I have two cats. One of them's a Norwegian forest cat. He's about 18 pounds. So he's a big cat, and he helps a lot with stress. Sometimes he works overtime. I play video games. Like, I'm really big on the Nintendo Switch Zelda games, and those will take up a lot of time. I got into that this summer because there's a new one, and it took the whole summer. That really helped get through the summer. But it's good to have the balance where you can get away from things and not fixate, because some of the stuff that revolves around burnout, whether you're a student, whether you're an employee, is that you get fixated and you think and keep thinking and thinking about issues. That's why you get cynical and exhausted. Whereas if you're doing something that's a hobby that you're passionate about, if you're doing something with your family, you can kind of get into a flow state with that where you just get disconnected and you're just focusing on riding your bike and you're not focusing on as much as anything else. And those things really help for you to balance it.
Do you have any guilty pleasures, like binge watching TV or anything like that?
Yeah, I like a lot of nerdy science fiction stuff, like reading too, guilty pleasures, fantasy. We don't have cable, so I don't get as much of that as I probably would. I used to, my wife and I, we used to watch a lot of HGTV and Home. Like, that would really be a guilty pleasure, but that would stress me out too because all these houses, you know, they're selling for so much. But, my guilty pleasure in many ways is trying to go around and play one video game, Zelda, and that's like the one game that I play. So it's like just getting addicted to that, you know, in a way is a guilty pleasure.
During your research and preparing for your book, did you come across any unusual antidotes or solutions that people use to cope with stress and trying to?
Yeah, that's interesting. That's an interesting question because that's a good, you know, that's why I talked earlier about self-reflecting and being able to figure out what works for you. Everybody has their own strategies to ensure work-life balance and keep burnout. Some people have strategies where they have a mantra they have at the end of the day. They'll turn their computer off and say something like, the work day has ended, or power down, like these weird mantras. But they really have effect to help you, now the work day is ending, I'm transitioning into something else for the rest of the day. Personally, one of the things I've done, and I've disconnected email from my, well, I haven't disconnected email. That's a struggle when you're addicted to email on your phone. But I've set it up where I can't get notices after a certain hour. So I'm not constantly in that mode where my phone's going off and I'm checking work email. But yeah, the mantra has been one of the things where I'm like, well, I'll try that. But every time I try, it just doesn't seem to work for me. Like, I'm turning off my computer and having this thing where the work day ends. But that's one of the things we found.
For me, I always just, and I've been like this for so long, so I don't even... So it's always weird to me when other people still have it set for their phones this way, but all of my social media notifications, email notifications, Teams, like all of that stuff is turned off. So I have to, for me, I manually have to check all of my apps if I want to know what's going on. So I don't, because, you know, that can easily be so overwhelming when, you know, you're being pinged the entire day for stuff. So for me, everything is turned off and I just have to check it.
And, you know, that's some of what's going on with the increase where people are concerned about work life burnout, is that we have so many, I don't want to say, they're not always distractions because they're useful, they're beneficial at times, sometimes, a lot of times they're not, but we have so many things that are on these computers we keep in our pockets that 20 years ago would have, you know, just didn't happen, where we're constantly pinged, we're constantly interrupted. So we're not able, we're exhausted because we're not able to take time to rest and have deep thoughts and deep reflection about the work we're doing. Even I'll have periods where I'll go to a coffee shop to write because there's, you know, there's so many things occupying my time for like for 5 minutes here and then 5 minutes there that you can't get in a mode where you need to really think and reflect. And I can't imagine how it is to study today in that, like with the constant, because my family used not to understand how I could study with the TV on news or something. I can't imagine now when there's so many distractions we have just on our phones and our attention span is pulled so many ways. And, you know, studies have shown that when you're working and you get an email and you go check that email, you get a social media notice, it really takes you a long time to get back on track with what you're doing. And those small everyday things add up. And a lot of research in burnout shows that the small everyday distractions that cause us stress has just as much effect, sometimes not more, than what we would think about large dramatic events in our work and life have on burnout. Mm. So just those little things add up a lot.
So last question.
Sure.
One thing that you could give to students and faculty watching this who are trying to not lose steam through midterms to make it to the end of the semester, what would you tell them?
Drink coffee if you can. If you can't have caffeine, don't. I went with 6 months without caffeine. That was the hardest 6 months of my life, I think, sometimes. Aww. But you know, really think back and think about what's your priorities. What's going to matter in 5 years or a year or a couple weeks? What's going to matter? And spend time on that. That's what really helps you deal with burnout and have a balance, work-life balance. You're never going to have that perfect work-life balance, so don't spend too much time stressing about it because that just adds one more thing to this list of achievements we have to get today. But really self-reflect and think about your priorities and what's going to be important in the future to you, and that's what you may need to spend more time on then.
Dr. Hatcher, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And for those watching, stay tuned because we'll be right back to continue our conversation with another guest.
Hello, my name is Yamil Santana, and I'm a counselor here at Augusta University. I wanted to take a moment to talk to you about Student Counseling and Psychological Services, also known as SCAPS. Our mission at SCAPS is to provide free and confidential mental health services for currently enrolled Augusta University students in a safe and inclusive environment. Our goal is to promote and preserve student wellness. We pursue our mission by delivering direct clinical care to students, in addition to brief therapy for individuals, group counseling, and crisis services. We also offer consultation, prevention, and outreach presentations. We also pride ourselves in our graduate level training program, which prepares future mental health professionals and supports Augusta University's academic mission. We provide all of these services through the highest standards of practice as guided by our professional and ethical codes of conduct. We help students better understand themselves, others, and the world around them so that they can make intentional and informed choices that facilitate wellness. You may be wondering, what are some of the concerns that bring students to SCAPS? Truth is, we see students for an extensive variety of concerns such as anxiety, depression, suicidal thoughts, and loneliness, among many other concerns. If you're wondering if your concerns are valid or if they could be addressed by working with a mental health professional, then please consider giving us a call. Contacting SCAPS is a great first step in moving in a helpful direction. If we believe we're not the resource for you, we'll make sure to point you in the right direction. We encourage you to make taking care of your mental health a priority during your journey here at Augusta University. and we invite you to let us support you along the way. Thank you, and may you be well.
Welcome back, y'all, to In the Wild, and helping us continue our conversation about all things mental health, work-life balance, and burnout is an assistant professor from the Department of Psychological Science, and we are so happy to have her here virtually on the big screen. So give a big jaguar welcome to Dr. Melanie Wilcox. How's it going?
Going all right. Thanks so much for having me here today.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Diving right in, the intersection of mental health and academic success is crucial, especially now, as we were talking to Dr. Hatcher earlier about kind of picking back up and being fast-paced again from the pandemic. So how did you become interested in studying mental health, and just what motivated you to kind of go into this?
Sure. So, you know, I've wanted to be a psychologist since I was really young. I can't remember a time where that wasn't the case. So questions about mental health and psychology generally, you know, why people do what they do. Those are questions that have guided me for as long as I can remember. But, you know, as it pertains to the intersection of academics and mental health, you know, I was a first generation college student. I came from a lower socioeconomic status background. I worked a lot through even high school, actually, then undergrad, worked a lot outside of my program in graduate school, had family responsibilities on top of that. And so just even based on my own experience, you know, I was so aware of the pressures that students face, especially students from historically marginalized backgrounds. And so it's just something that, given my experience, I've been especially passionate about recognizing the pressures that students face and how that can impact mental health.
Could you elaborate a little bit more on the challenges that students kind of face as they matriculate through college?
Sure. So, you know, it's a difficult question to answer because there are so many stressors that students face that can impact mental health. You know, in fact, research shows that students are often experiencing a lot of anxiety before they even come to campus. We're in this sort of like epidemic of anxiety era. And so before we even start talking about college pressures, when students arrive to campus, many of them are already carrying a lot with them and may be coming in with anxiety or depression or even other mental health concerns. And then we are adding to that a major transition, which is coming to college. We are adding the academic stresses and pressures. And a lot of students, you know, want to do well. And, you know, students are often taking credit-bearing classes, they're maybe doing extracurricular activities, and then there are a lot of students who work jobs outside of their schooling. Students have family responsibilities and roles in their family that some students will have to continue to upkeep. And those are just some of the things off the top of my head, you know. And so you can imagine these things as sort of layering, right? Like they come in with a certain level of stress, anxiety, maybe other mental health struggles. Then we're adding the academic pressures on top of that and all the things that they have to get done, maybe extracurricular roles, jobs, family roles and responsibilities. And you can imagine these things just sort of like piling onto their backs, like weight, right? And those become the things the students are carrying around with them as they're trying to navigate school. And so all of that stress and pressure can easily lead to or exacerbate mental health issues.
Yeah, when you say that, that makes me think of my own like undergrad experience, because I'm a first generation college graduate as well. And I came to campus with this internalized fear of like, I'm afraid to ask for help because I'm afraid that someone will tell me like, I don't belong here, right? Because, you know, I'm first gen, I don't really have the support system at home, so if I don't necessarily have that support system here, like, I'm afraid to ask or admit that I may not belong here on campus. So that, I definitely can relate because I was carrying that on my back for quite some time until I realized, like, oh no, like, all of these campus resources are here because, you know, they're for everyone, not just, you know, because I'm first gen, but because they know that all students need the most basic help and a little bit of everything.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you sharing that. And that, you know, the research shows that that's very consistent for first generation college students and was certainly similar to my experience as well. And then in addition to the, you know, not wanting to ask because I don't want to make it seem like I don't belong here, sometimes you don't know what questions to ask or who to ask or where the resources might be, right? Sort of call that college knowledge. There are, you know, a lot of first-gen students might not have a lot of college knowledge because they don't have others in their lives who can sort of bring them up to speed on those things. And so for so many reasons, first-gen students will are often, you know, be ignored or invisible or not receive the resources that they need to be successful.
Could you talk a little bit about any examples or studies that you've researched that kind of highlight more of that, like, those barriers that students may have which wanting to connect to being on campus with whatever mental health issues they may be carrying, like you mentioned earlier?
Sure. So, you know, there's sort of like the social piece of that, and then there's the constraints that students face, right? So on the one hand, we know that when students don't feel a sense of belongingness on campus, they tend to have poor academic outcomes. And so when we can foster a sense of belongingness for students, exactly like you were just talking about, then it can help students feel more connected to their campus, their community, and just by virtue of that having a positive effect on mental health, as well as connecting them with resources, they tend to academically do better. And then, you know, the other piece to that is that it's sometimes hard to feel a sense of belonging when there are constraints on one's time and resources, right? And so some of my research looks at things like basic needs insecurity, so food insecurity, housing insecurity, the extent to which students are working out, a lot of hours at outside jobs because they're having difficulty making ends meet. Again, all the many roles and responsibilities that students hold today, even more so than previous generations. And so for one, you know, if you're going to class and then you're going to a job and you're there until midnight and then you've got just enough time to get a few hours of sleep before you get up and do it all over again, you know, when are, and how are you going to have a sense of belonging? Right? If you don't have the luxury of participating in the campus community, and that's to say nothing of the burnout that can happen when students are just going because they have so much on their plates. And so you have sort of this like multi-pathway setup for mental health detriments between the social disconnectedness and the burnout and the pressure.
So earlier with Dr. Hatch, we were talking more about work-life balance. So I was curious, with your expertise, could you talk a little bit more about school life balance or class work balance, shifting to the academic side of things? Because like you mentioned earlier, like that can be that extra barrier that students have trying to be a full-time student, but also working full-time or part-time and all the things that, you know, they have on their plate.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really tough, and certainly it's tough on the work-life balance part, but, you know, I think that it's uniquely difficult for students. They're pulled in just so many different directions, and, you know, what's tough is that on the one hand, like, the schoolwork needs to get done, and then on the other hand, like, if students have a lot of outside responsibilities, it's not like there's a lot to give up, right? It's often hard to, like, pull back on certain things because they need more time or because they're experiencing burnout. And, you know, that these very real logistical constraints can make balance very, very difficult to achieve. Something that I've come to think about when it comes to, we want to call it work-life balance or, you know, academic or student life balance is, you know, I think that we often talk about that balance as though it is a state that we can achieve. Like, I have found the balance, I have it now, and I shall protect it at all costs, right? And I think instead what happens is this constant, very fluid thing, right? Like, sometimes we might be giving more to our academics. Sometimes we might be giving more to our social life and things like that. And it's not about finding that perfect state of balance. It's about assessing for yourself, what do I need right now? How do I feel? How is this sort of breakdown of my time and energy working for me? And recognizing that it's never going to be perfect. There's too much going on. Some things are always going to fall through the cracks. But does this feel like it's okay enough for me right now? Is it accomplishing what I need to accomplish? And if not, what needs to change? What realistically can change for me? And how can I prioritize my health and my mental health in assessing for that balance? So it's a difficult thing, but I think starting with that recognition that it's fluid and ever changing is necessary if we're going to try to attain anything resembling balance.
As a professor, what would be a way you recommend to students to let you know that, like, hey, I'm struggling, or I don't know how I'm going to, you know, pull through the rest of this semester? What would you recommend?
Yeah, you know, as soon as you started asking that question and I had a sense of where you were going, my immediate response was, you know, tell me, you know, I can't be helpful as a professor if I don't know what's going on. And I think that students are understandably often reluctant to express that they're struggling to seek help and resources. And, you know, sometimes that's on the basis of having had less than helpful experiences sometimes when they've asked for help. And so I want to honor and acknowledge that that's very real. And, you know, we can never know for sure how a particular person will respond when you reach out for that help. But, you know, to the extent possible, try to get to know your professors at least a little bit, so that you feel as though you have enough of a relationship to feel comfortable saying to a particular professor, I'm really struggling and I need help. I think most of us get into this profession, higher education in general, because we care and we want to be helpful. And so, you know, we often will want to work with students to try to help you find a way forward, but we can't do that if we don't know that you're struggling. And so ask for what you need. You know, as my partner likes to say, no's are free, right? So that if you need an extension, if you need more time on something, if you need some assistance on something, the worst answer that you can get is no, right? But you cannot get any assistance if you don't ask, right? If we don't know that you're struggling. So I cannot stress it enough. Reach out, ask for help, ask for what you need, ask for, you know, a connection to resources that might be able to help you. Because that's the best shot that we have at trying to be of assistance to you.
Yeah, I think that was probably one of the mistakes I made the most often during my undergrad experience, is not asking for help when I know I needed it, because I was afraid that my professor would be upset with me, or like you mentioned before, like I didn't have that connection or that relationship built to where I could just tell them, like, I haven't talked to them at all this semester, and now this is my first time actually taking them up on their offer for help, and it's embarrassing. So I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and the only reason that I am able to, like, articulate these things now is because, you know, in my own undergraduate experience, you know, in general, I characterologically don't ask for help very well. So I also want to acknowledge that, that I'm sitting here saying, ask for help, and I'm terrible at it. If my partner or my friends watch this, they're going to laugh very hard, be like, at least she was honest, because it's still true of me. But, you know, when I was an undergrad, during the second half of my undergraduate years, I was working midnight to 8, Monday through Friday, and sometimes overtime shifts as well. I was a caretaker for my dad, who was often very ill. And so I remember there was a particular day, I'll never forget it. It was in my theories of psychotherapy class. And I think it was like a midday class. Like I worked midnight to 8, and then my dad was sick and in the hospital. So instead of going to sleep, I went to the hospital and I was there all day. And so by the time I got to my class at like 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I hadn't slept in at least a day. And obviously that's like, you know, the hospital was all very stressful. I must have looked like, I don't even know, but as soon as I saw my professor, who was also my advisor, and he had some, he knew me, right? And that helped a lot too. So he had some sense of what was probably going on. And he was like, Mel, go home, go get some sleep. Like, I know you'll get the work done. I know that you will catch up, but you've got to rest. You've got to sleep. So get out of this class, go home, go to bed. And it seems like the simplest intervention, telling someone, hey, look, go to bed. But it meant the world to me, because I don't ask for help easily. And because it sort of felt like it was my responsibility as a student to find a way to push through and, you know, stay up for 48, 72 hours. And I sleep what I sleep when I sleep. But the reality is that even academically, it's better for students if we can take care of ourselves first. And so the only reason that I can even articulate these things is because I had professors who were so proactive about seeing that in me that, you know, that I needed the additional help, I needed the support, and that I needed to sleep, and pushed me to do so, even when I was like, no, I'll be fine, it'll be fine, you know, and just weren't having it. Like, nope, take care of yourself first.
Switching gears a little bit, in 2023, like, we have access to so many devices that keep us connected with each other, and platforms to keep us connected with each other, like social media, which can often over time kind of overwhelm our brains. Yeah. And mindfulness has become a really bigger topic over the, you know, last couple of years. Are there any mindfulness techniques or stress techniques that you would recommend to students, just kind of to help them get through their day if they're just like, I need to spend some time away from my phone, away from screens, but I don't know how to turn things off?
Yeah. Away from my phone and away from screens is the key piece there, right? Because whenever someone is like, what app can I use for de-stressing? It's like, okay, like in a pinch, there might be a few helpful things. But the biggest thing is that we need to give ourselves a second to be human again. And so whenever I'm talking to audiences or things like that about burnout, I often say, like, don't skip past the basics, right? Like, think about the example that I just gave of a useful intervention from a professor, right? And it wasn't some fancy app or like, go play this sport. It was go take a nap. It was the best intervention that someone could have done for me, you know, like, when have you eaten last kind of thing. And so going back to basics is actually some of the most important stuff that we can do when we're feeling stressed. For as rudimentary as it sounds, it doesn't mean that there won't be things that we need to do in addition, but like, have I slept? When have I last had a glass of water? Have I had anything to eat other than like a bag of hot Cheetos in a day or so, you know, like something of substance? Have I experienced social connection? And different people need different levels of social connection and engagement, but we are social creatures by nature. And so sometimes if we've been cramming for a test for 12 hours, we feel isolated and lonely. And so, you know, you can tick two boxes at once, get lunch with a friend or something that pulls you out of work mode, pulls you out of, you know, I've got my face in a screen mode, and gets you back connected, even if briefly, with the most human parts of ourselves, our basic needs, social connection, and allowing ourselves a minute to breathe where we're not just like producing. Those are some of the best things that we can do. It's going to look different for everyone. Some people might want to get out into nature. Some people might want to sit inside with a good book that's not an academic book for a little bit, right? But something that reconnects you to you and reconnects you to the people in your life, even if it's for a half an hour, can make a huge difference.
Yeah, for me, sometimes I just have to tell myself, like, intentionally, like, I'm going to unplug. Like, I will literally turn my phone off or sometimes just leave it on the charger. And I'm like, I'm going to go clean my apartment or just do something that I say I've been going to do for weeks now and just, like, take care of it for an hour or 2 hours. And just unplugging for even that short a period of time can really, like I've found, to be very stress relieving for me.
Yes, absolutely. And it's a good reminder too that like if you have a watch that's connected to your phone, take that off too, because otherwise someone's going to text you and it's still going to buzz on your phone. It's going to reconnect you to that digital life real quick. So unplug means unplug, step away for a little bit.
Yeah, and I also, because I know sometimes there are folks on social media that will kind of make these big announcements like, yeah, I'm unplugging or I'm going to, you know, step away from social media for blah, 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 and they don't really do it, but they at least tell us that they do it. For me, I just kind of like to, you know what, this Saturday, I'm just going to go dark. I'm not going to say anything to anybody. I'm just going to do it. I'll come back on or respond to messages whenever, and I found that to be very helpful.
Yeah.
Or switching gears again a little bit, beyond the institutional support, because the university does provide a lot of resources for students, like student counseling, student health, so many academic support centers. I don't want to, you know, name them all because there's so many. But beyond that, Is there anything that you would recommend for like students themselves to do to help prioritize their own mental health as they, you know, just journey on through college?
Yeah, I think, you know, first and foremost, be proactive. You know, too often when we're feeling stressed or, you know, we're feeling anxious, we feel like we're struggling with depression, we don't, kind of like we were talking about before, we don't reach out for help until it reaches some crisis point, right? And there's so much that we can do before it reaches that point. And I think sometimes, understandably, students feel like, well, I don't have time for that. I'm so busy, right? And, you know, to some extent, that's true. And we are often going to lose so much more time in the long run if we wait until it's absolutely terrible, right? Until we're so stressed out that we can't cope. And so, you know, checking in with yourself regularly about how you're feeling, you know, the emotions that you're experiencing, the degree of stress that you're experiencing, whether you do feel connected to the people in your life or if you're feeling more isolated, and then taking measures to address those things early and making those assessments of oneself often, because we can get so into like work mode, just got to get stuff done, that there can be stuff brewing underneath there and we don't realize it until it boils over. And so the more that we can be proactive about taking care of ourselves, checking in with ourselves about how we're feeling, reaching out and using some of those resources that you were just talking about earlier than people often reach out for them, it will often save us time and headache in the long run.
So on a lighter note, if you were to create a mental health 101 class to help students survive midterms and finish the semester strong, what would be a unusual yet effective lesson you would teach them?
An unusual yet effective lesson. I think, I don't know if it's unusual per se, but I do think that when we get in like study mode, it can feel paradoxical. Like slow and steady wins the race, right? The, you know, instead of sitting there and studying for something for 4 hours, study for 30, 45 minutes, get up, get a glass of water, come back and restart it. Study for another 30 to 45 minutes, you know, get up, get a snack, come back to it. This is consistent with what we know from educational psychology too. You're actually more likely to retain information when you study in like 30 to 45 minute chunks than if you cram for hours at a time. And if you can take even longer breaks, even better. But all the things that I know that everything I keep coming back to is back to basic. It's like, well, sleep isn't complicated, right? And yet if we were to ask students, you know, right now, how many hours on average are you sleeping per night as we get closer and closer to midterms? That number is probably reducing, and it's obviously not great for mental health, but it's not even great for your exam grades. You know, the best thing that you can do is shave off a little bit of time studying, maybe start earlier, you know, and start in the days and weeks that lead up to it instead of waiting until the last minute so that you feel like you have a little bit more of that time. But even if you are under the wire, prioritizing sleep, eating well, drinking water, maybe taking the time for exercise, taking the time for social connection, and building that in, at least in small bits around your studying, will make you happier and healthier. And that's going to lead to likely better performance on midterms as well.
Any final message that you'd like to send to our students who are gearing up for midterms or to power through the rest of the semester?
Yeah, absolutely. For one, you've got this, you know, so study, take care of yourselves. And if you do those things, you've got this. And by the time we are through midterms, then you are going to blink and the semester will be over. It goes by so quickly. And so I know this can feel like the slog, right? Like you got to make it through midterms and then it's like, oh, it's still not over. Like I still have more to do. But the reality is, you know, we'll have a brief break and then be Thanksgiving and then it's going to be December before you know it. So you're almost off this ride for the semester. By the time you're at midterms. So, you know, study, take care of yourselves, and if you do those things, you've got this.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wilcox, for sharing all those insights with us. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us a little bit today. And to all of our listeners, all of our watchers, please take care of yourselves. Midterms, you got this.
Thanks so much for having me. Good luck, everyone.